Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to see all you sickies. I've told this story the other night, and I'll repeat it this morning, but I was born and raised in Brooklyn. It's just like Phoenix. But I'll tell you, we don't have the hustle you guys have. I mean, you got a hole in the ground, and people come from all over the world to fill it in. You know, we had that stuff in New York. We call them subways. But it reminds me of when I moved out to California, which was in 1974. And I had come from New York, and I went to a meeting there. It was the first meeting I went to, and Clinton was there. And the 2nd of July, that would be 15 years. And when my anniversary is July 5th of 70, and I was three days away from taking a cake, and I went to this meeting, and I had never been to California. In fact, I hadn't been too many places. I was to a lot of places where I know about parole and that kind of stuff, but I didn't know a lot about this traveling, free will. And so the deal was, is I got out of my car and I walked across the parking lot, and I was dressed, not knowing anything about California, I dressed the way they thought I should dress back in New York. So I had on white patent leather shoes. I had on check red pants. I had on a black shirt with pink piping. And Clint made the comment, "You're no down-home boy." And he gave me a four-year cake. The following week at that same meeting, and 15 years have elapsed in between. And the deal is that the only time we see Clint anymore in San Diego is when he comes over to have his points and plugs changed and his oil checked, and he maximizes his Blue Cross and Blue Shield. I really enjoyed the speakers, all of them. I mean, it's just fantastic. I come to these things and I hear these stories, and I'm always amazed at the capacity for human beings to go through stuff and come out the other side. And then I think a lot of people are wasting their time. They could be doing things like writing books. I mean, I would buy a copy of Hillary's dating guide. I mean, I'd pay 20 bucks. I really would. I tried to watch her last night to see where she drifted, you know, like. And then I figured I wouldn't go near that guy. And there's a rumor that started. I don't know who started it or where it started or when it started. But the deal is that there are normal people and there are us. Now, as the president says, watch my lips. There are no normal people. There are just people who haven't shared with you yet. You know? I mean, you go into a grocery store and you see things like mint-flavored dog biscuits. Normal people buy that kind of stuff. You wonder, why don't they just pour Lavoris in the toilet, you know? And let the dog have at it. Uh, And you see, in San Diego, the status symbol in throughout most of Southern California is a pickup truck. And the idea is to have the most vicious dog you can find in the back of this pickup truck. That's normal. And then when the dog barks, you get some real clever-looking guy who looks at that dog and says things like, "Why are you barking?" And you feel like yelling out because he doesn't know how to whistle. You know, like, And you go around and you watch signs and you just observe things. That's, for me, sobriety has been more than just a spiritual awakening. It's like a total encompassing of what's going on around me. My world had become so myopic when I was drinking. And then the deal is that you see signs and you say, what does this mean? Like normal people put doors in places and then it says, this door is to remain closed at all times. You know? You take kids to a fast food restaurant, you tell them to eat slow, you know? It's a lot of confusion. And you guys from Flagstaff are not exempt. Downtown in your little Dunkin' Donuts, as you come through the door, there's a big sign. It says, "Desert your family, $1.59. Very, very interesting stuff. You know, I've had a chance to share before at some function similar to this, and so I know how they work. I use my words, and then you guys apply your meanings. And then afterward, people come up and they credit you with saying something you never said. And they tell you how much it meant to them. And I like that. That's very nice. But the flip side of that is you always get some bozo who comes up and credits you with something you never said, and on top of that, he disagrees with it. And I always remember that the original Saturday Night Live, God bless Gilda Radner, when she used to do that things about, why are we so upset about fleet erections in South America? And they would say, no, Emily, that's free elections in South America. And she'd say, never mind. You know, and our frame of reference is entirely different. And that's what makes this thing so amusing. And the deal is I'm reminded of the guy who had a 7-year-old son and he sent him to Southern California and this kid was born and raised in New York. And he got out to California to visit his cousin and his cousin said, you know, I want to share something with you. He said, today, he said, I found a condom on the patio. And the kid from New York said, what the hell's a patio? You know, and we feel like we're reaching all kinds of people. You know, AA today is probably more well known than at any time and any point in history, and yet you wonder who we're reaching. When a guy like Senator Tower can come on national television and say, I've never done this, and if I get this job, I'll never do it again. <You know? laughs> And the other guy, Dukaki or whatever, he comes on and he said, my wife became an alcoholic because I lost the election. Oh, yeah. I'm sure glad you don't have your finger on the nuclear button. As observant as you are. It must have been a hell of November in your house when she just catapulted right over the invisible line. If you tend to be of the intellectual ilk, you can go to sleep right now. Because I got through school totally unscarred by education. And fortunately, you don't need a lot of that stuff. I grew up with and got sober with guys who still think that Moby Dick is a venereal disease. You know? In my neighborhood, you say there's a dead bird, we all look up, you know. That's, Teacher asked a buddy of mine, how do you spell Mississippi? He said, you mean the river of the state, you know. But growing up in the streets in New York City, I picked up a lot of things. Fortunately, they're all curable. And I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. Now, I'm not saying everybody who's Italian is in the mafia. I'm not even saying there's a mafia. In fact, I think I'll leave that subject alone. But they taught me in this neighborhood two things that have held me in good stead. And they told me that education was never as valuable as experience. And that helped me when I came into AA. And so we weren't told to go get a lot of education, but we were really encouraged in the neighborhood to go get a lot of experience. Because they knew from experience that when a man with money meets a man with experience, the guy who has the experience will end up with the money. And the guy who had the money will end up with an experience. And the second thing they taught me, which is very important, is money talks, but cash screams. So I learned to get into situations where there was cash. And when I was fairly young, my dad passed away. And his anniversary of his death is in this month. He died Father's Day. And I remember that my dad was not a big drinker for most of his life. At least I remember that part of his life where he wasn't. And he started drinking about age 44, and by 50 he was dead. And I could identify very much with Hillary when she shared last night about how you get pregnant. You know, all the guys in my neighborhood proposed with the same two words. You're what? You know? And in those days, that was an indictment, you know, like, if you did it, you paid the price. And so I could very well relate to that. But my dad passed away at 50, and I had a chance to see him in the throes of his alcoholism, the worst part of it. And he died Father's Day. And the deal is that if knowledge alone was worth anything, I had all the knowledge I needed, because I had a chance to observe it. But in Bill's story, he talks about the fact that he had a hospital stay, and when he came out, he said, surely this must be the answer, self-knowledge. And then in writing the book, the very next sentence says, but it is not. They knew who they were going to be dealing with. And the deal here is that if you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I call the owner's manual, and you should have one of those in your possession, don't let anybody read the big book to you. Don't let anybody quote it to you. Don't let anybody interpret it to you, at least not in the beginning. Because sometimes they have books that don't come out of New York, I'm sure. What they read in there just doesn't exist. And I went to, in my case, I went to my first AA meeting and was back in New York. And the day before I decided to come, I don't know about you guys, but I didn't get here on a winning streak. And the day before I decided to come, I was living with my mom in a senior citizen place, and I was the only one under 65 breathing there. And I slept on a couch in the living room, and my mom would get up early, and of course I would sleep in late. And the deal was, is all the little biddies would come over, and they would say things like, he's still with you, Trudy. And she'd say, smilingly, yes. And I would hear that every single morning. And it got so, I was there for so long, I learned how to use the walker. You know? I learned all about how to use the oxygen. I mean, I was catching on there. I thought maybe this was it. And I was sitting there the day before I finally came into my first AA meeting, and I knew I was in trouble. I was unemployed and unemployable. I had about a 5-day growth of beard. I was sitting in front of the television because it was the afternoon watching the Flintstones. My wife and kids had left me and moved out of state very wisely. And I was in the process of going to jail because I had a habit when I was drinking of finding things before people officially lost them. And I was sitting there on this typical day in my castle. And my wife had been gone several months at this point, and I began to notice that Wilma had a cute ass. Not as nice as Mrs. Jetson, but it was nice, you know. And so I had been told by several people that I was not doing too good. And that drinking was probably the root of my problem. And so I ended up at my first AA meeting. And I met a guy there that night. And that guy was to be my sponsor at that time, and he still is today. And he gave me the owner's manual that night. And he said, take this home and read it. And keep coming to these meetings. And what so many people are told early on in Alcoholics Anonymous, that all you have to do is come here, attend the meetings, and do the things that are suggested, and you're going to be okay. And that's real hard to register when your whole life is coming apart. And we tell that very easily to newcomers. We almost tell it now like it's rehearsed over and over and over. We've said it so many times. But that's the way it is. And I took that big book home. And I was always on an ego trip that someday I would live my life in such a way that somebody would write a book about me. And they did, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I read each page, I could see me in there. And I read where it said things like, if the alcoholic doesn't drink, he tends to act much like other men. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. That's why the three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, I've been thinking. And that has been mentioned here also. We can take any solution and turn it into a problem. You know? We scratch stuff that don't itch. We have the kind of minds, we go to a wedding, we want to be the bride. We go to a funeral, we want to be the corpse. And we want to do it with a lot of humility, you know? And the one thing for sure is we're never thinking in the now. We're always projected out somewhere. It's like the guy who met a gal in Vegas and he said he'd like to spend the night with her. And she said, absolutely not. He said, I'll give you $10,000. And within moments, they were upstairs on a bed nude. And she said, kiss me on the lips. And he did. And he said, I don't know. She said, okay, then kiss me on the neck. And he did. And he said, I don't know. Finally, she said, kiss me on the breast, and he did, and he said, I don't know. She said, what don't you know? He said, I don't know where I'm going to get the 10 grand, you know? See, that's alcoholic thinking. You're right in the middle of a good thing, and you're projecting a problem. And the other thing we do is we take responsibility for things we never had anything to do with. It's like Mr. Mouse goes out and cruises the bars, and he picks up Miss Elephant. And he takes her home, and they make passionate love all night long. And in the morning, when Mr. Mouse gets up and he's rubbing his eyes, he looks over, and there's Miss Elephant. She's on her back, her feet are in the air, she's dead as a doornail. And he says, wow, one night of fun, and I spend the rest of my life digging a grave. People come to AA meetings, and when you come in from the outside, and Clint touched on it this morning, this is the darndest program, because here we laugh when we should cry, and we cry when we should laugh, and we call it AA. But when people come in from the outside and they see us laughing, and some poor bozo is up here pouring his heart out, you know, they think we're laughing at his problem. And we never laugh at people's problems. They're serious. We're laughing at their solutions, you know? You poke the person next to you and say, what did they say? You know? You just can't believe it's happening. And if you're going to be a sponsor, which is very big now, if you're going to be a sponsor, please help the person you're sponsoring by being a good listener. Learn to listen. Sponsors have a tendency, I think they send them to a school in Pasadena, and they have verbal skills. How much can I say in a minute? And the deal is you have to learn to listen, because most of the time when an alcoholic opens his mouth to talk, he has absolutely no idea what he's going to say. And you have to allow someone the opportunity to talk for a few minutes uninterrupted before they get to the point. And you could jump in there very easy and give them a solution to a problem they don't have. And then for 2 years you watch them run around trying to find it. And they think they're in denial, but they never had it to begin with. It's like the guy who was 86 years old who showed up at the sperm bank. And he said he wanted to leave a deposit. And the nurse said, sir, you're 86 years old. He said, I want to leave a deposit. So she said, here's a jar. Take it down the hall, fill it up, and bring it back. So he did. And after about a half hour, she became concerned. So she walked down, knocked at the door, and she heard this pathetic voice say, come in. So she walked in and saw this guy in the corner. He looked like he'd been wrestling with a gorilla. And he looked at her and he said, miss, he said, I've used my right hand. He said, I've used my left hand. He said, I even banged it off the wall. He said, I can't get the lid off this jar. Now it would be real easy to jump in there with a solution to a problem he doesn't have. And that's why you have to learn to be a good listener. And that's why we allow people at every level in Alcoholics Anonymous to share. Because we know sooner or later they're going to forget themselves and tell the truth. And when they say it, it's almost like they forget and then they bring it back, you know. But that's why the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, my copy, and that's what I'm going to talk about, my copy. In my copy, it talks about having to make this journey, which is the biggest journey in life, and that is out of the head and into the heart. Everything in my life worth anything emanates from my heart. It doesn't come from my head. My head gives me ambition and common sense in some areas to buy stuff at the Alpha Beta. Outside of that, it's almost worthless. The things that make any difference in my life, God, love, all those things that mean something to me come from my heart. And that's the trip that the big book that I have talks about. It says things like, I will be rocketed into the fourth dimension. In other words, I'll be in a place, as Bill talks about it, where for the first time I'll see things in a whole different way that I had never seen before, and I couldn't see them before because I wasn't spiritually fit. There's absolutely no way you're going to see spiritual things without a spiritual program. Doesn't happen that way. Doesn't mean they're not happening, you just won't see them. And then it says we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Being unscarred by education, I looked up that word intuitively. It says to bypass the thought process. And then it says we'll develop a sixth sense, which means you won't have to see it, touch it, smell it, taste it, feel it. You'll just know it. You'll just know. After a while, and this is one of the great paradoxes in AA, we know that everybody with less than 2 years knows everything. And that's why they don't ask you to go anywhere to share. Because you know everything. And after you hear about 10, 12, 15 years, you begin to realize how very little you know about anything. And that's when they ask you to go everywhere. They'll even pay you away if you say things like, I don't know nothing. Because, see, then you can't hurt anyone. But that's what happens. God begins to intervene in your life, and he's been intervening all along. If you come and you listen to enough AA speakers, what you will hear, without any doubt, is exactly the same story. The play has changed, the names changed, the locations changed, the numbers of times certain things are done changed, but it's the same story. It's this horrendous prologue of all these events in your life that you couldn't control, that you had absolutely no control over, and you had no control over yourself. And then you hear people say, something happened. And I went to my first AA meeting. Something happened. I get a call in a phone booth from my sister. Something happened. Some military guy says to me, something happened. Something happens. And that something happening is a spiritual experience. And you don't have to be aware of it. Hell, you didn't even know you were drunk. And the deal is that the book talks about that very clearly. It says, when the alcoholic takes in alcohol, something happens. That's the best they can come up with. I mean, they've been working on this problem for years and years and years. Grants, whatever, and all they can come up with, well, something happens. You know? We can tell you what happens afterward, but just something happens. And that something happening is a spiritual experience, God intervening in your life. And for the first time, you begin to know what something is all about without knowing anything about it. And life begins to take on a shape and a form you never dreamed of. And that happens when you start operating from your heart over and over and over again. You need experience in that area. And the book, to me, talks about that stuff. You know, the average alcoholic that you talk to only has four basic responses, and none of them are spiritual. You know, they say things like, yes, but, and you don't understand, and I'm different. That's the big one. I'm different, you know. And then the fourth one is very casually, I know that. And that's how you know when you're working with a real alcoholic, they have the capacity to say very little else. They know everything and they're in pain constantly. And so what I have learned here, and it's been the best lesson for me, is making this trip out of my head and into my heart and learning about love and things that I never really understood before. And love, I hate definitions. That's why I think when people try to define God and love, they limit it. And you can't limit those things. They're without definition and they're really without boundaries. But the best definition that I have that I can work with is love is the process whereby we lead you gently back to yourself. That's what love is. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, my copy of the big book talks about that. It says after step two, I'll be reborn. It doesn't say I'll be born, meaning I'll do it for the first time, but I'll be reborn. There's no doubt in my mind that when we're sent out from the home office, we're okay. But along the way, you watch people try to control kids. And we take these innocent lives and we twist them. And nobody does it deliberately, I'm sure. It just happens. And you get a chance to observe that if you watch kids. Kids have such simple solutions to life that we don't like them as adults. You know, it's like the dad who says to the kid, why are you scratching your head? And he said, because I'm the only one who knows it itches. You know, that's the way kids think. And you get a chance to see kids in all kinds of situations. I shared in a Northern California town about a year ago, and a mother was checking into the hotel with her son, and she was dragging him up the stairs. And he was about 5, 6, 7 years old in that area. And he said to her, I want to eat. And she said to him, we're not going to eat until we're hungry. At which point he said, I'm hungry. And she dragged him another 3 or 4 steps. And he said, I want to eat. And she said, we're not going to eat until we're very hungry. At which point he said, I'm very hungry. I started to laugh. She said, please don't encourage him. I said, lady, gave you 2 great answers. You know, like... But that's the way kids are. It's very, very simple with them. And how many times do you hear an adult say to a kid, that's the way it is? Because that means they don't have an answer. That's the way it is. And you get a chance to see the kids. And if you watch and you're sober, you get a chance to understand that nobody's doing this stuff deliberately. It's just happening. If you say over and over and over again, I'm hungry, and someone says you're not. If you say I'm cold and someone says you're not. If you say I'm afraid and someone says you can't be. After a while, you don't know what you're feeling. And if you do know what you're feeling, you don't know how to express it. Because you know someone's going to give you a judgmental call. So what you learn to do is you learn to either shut up entirely and withdraw, or you learn secret ways of getting it out, or you invent mythical characters and you talk about them, and then in that way you can get your ideas out. John said, Mary said, Larry said, the guys say, you know. And that's the way it is. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we have an all-loving God. We're God's kids. And there isn't a person here who can't get sober and stay sober. Anything you tell yourself is a lie. It's the big lie. And what you feel isn't so important in the beginning. It's what you do. The guys who wrote this big book really throw us off the track because they have things like how it works. You know, that really is deceiving. Oh, how does it work? Well, I guess maybe I'll look in this chapter. And this is not about into thinking, into analyzing, into evaluating, into equating. It's into action. These are the steps we took. And in taking the steps, you get the desired end. And when you start out, you don't even know what the desired end is. And you tell yourself the same story over and over and over again until eventually you believe it. I'm firmly convinced in my case that my ego was created because I didn't know anything about God. And I had to have a center, so I created a mythical person. And then I went about living in my life to support that character that I created. That was entirely false. And I knew it was fictional. I didn't know that at first, but I knew it later on when I began to take the steps. Because in taking the steps, what happens is I introduce fact into my life. And fact overwhelms fiction. Fiction cannot stand up to it. And as I looked at the reality of it, I began to see, and things began to come together for me, that I had to die to the person I was, or the person I really am couldn't live. And that's why I had to be reborn. And I don't want to tell you it's an easy process, but it's simple. I don't want to say it takes forever. Sometimes it takes 12, 15, 18 days. You talk to people, they have it all worked out. Took me a little longer. But the deal was, as I was in process of getting well, and I didn't even know what was going on. And whenever I had any thoughts about anything, you know, I had a sponsor that I would call him up. He was this warm, sensitive guy. And I would say to him, everything I said to him, he said was good. My wife left. Good, 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 good. I'm going to jail. Oh, good, 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 good. I'm going to lose custody of my kids. Oh, good, 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 good. I'm living with my mom. Oh, wonderful, wonderful, good. And then I would call him on the phone, and after seeing him in a meeting, somehow I couldn't tell him face to face what I was feeling, so I'd go home and call him. And when I called him, he'd pick up the phone and I'd start to tell him exactly what I was feeling. And he would say these great things like, hey, maybe you'll get lucky and die tonight and hang up. And I figured, what a guy, you know. He's there for you, you know. I can share with this man. I can tell him all my secrets. But he knew what I needed. And he knew about me more than I knew about myself because he had been through the ropes before. And I remember when I finally moved away from my mom, and this was my spiritual experience that I was aware of. I was 6 months sober, and I moved out of my mom's place for better quarters. And I moved into an area that wasn't so hot. There were junkies in the hall, and it wasn't a class act. But it was mine. And I went down to the Salvation Army, and I bought a bed. And I put the bed in there, and I had all my clothes in boxes, and I had no furniture. And I had a little orange crate that I kept a lamp on and a Hummel that my wife had given me. And actually, it was a gift to us when we got married, and I kept it there. And when people would come to visit me, they'd have to sit on the floor, so I'd say, sit down real carefully so as not to break that Hummel. And my sponsor came to see me, and he was the kind of guy who had a tremendous amount of intuitive thought. And he was kind of older then, and I said to him, sit down. And as he started to sit down, I said, don't touch that crate, because you may break that Hummel. At which point he said, this Hummel? And he picked it up. And I said, yeah. And he threw it off the wall. And it shattered all over the living room. And he said, take it easy, kid. Now you don't have to worry about shit. And here I went from this position of wealth and power to having very little. And I went to the meeting that night, and I came home from the meeting. And I could leave my doors open after that because there was nothing to take. You know, I didn't have to be worried about that Hummel. All my attention wasn't focused on that Hummel. And I went to this meeting, and I came home, and I got into this bed, and I pulled the covers up. And I said my prayers, which I had started to say at that time. And I became painfully aware of something in my life that I had never experienced before. And what I became painfully aware of that I had never experienced before was that I was comfortable. I was comfortable with me. I was in that bed. There was nothing in my life that was threatening me right then. Oh, there were a lot of outside forces, but inside I was okay. And it had been 6 months since I picked up a drink. And I had never done that before. And so I began to realize that not that it was going to be okay, but for the first time in my life, it was okay. I was right there in the moment. Everything was good. I knew something good was going to happen because I felt so good. I felt so positive about everything. And I was separated from my wife for 14 months. She had already started to file for divorce and stuff. And eventually, we got back together. And those kids got back with me. And I hadn't been able to see them for a period of time. And that marriage stayed together for another 10 years. And after 22 years of marriage, when we thought we had everything worked out, it wasn't. And she had to go in another direction at that point. And she went off in that direction. And the two boys at that time were older, and they decided to stay with me just because it was a better shot for them at that time. And I had a chance to spend some real special time with those kids that I would have missed entirely had I been drinking. I got back the time that I had lost, and I had a chance to participate solely in their life and do some things that I had never thought of doing before. And we had a good little deal. And after my wife and I were divorced, my kids started talking to me about going out and dating. My son came in one night, actually both of them, they decided to have a conference. My one boy, my oldest boy, said, Dad, why don't you wake up and smell the coffee? You got to get back in life, and you should start dating. Now, I don't know about anyone else in the audience, but when I was married and I was drinking, I was married. That's just the way I was. You know, some guys go into bars, they say, looking for bush. I went into the bar and was a bush. I sucked up everything that was liquid in the bar. You know, that's what I did. And I hadn't asked anybody out since Eisenhower was president. And I knew nothing about dating. And I don't know, most of you look like you're under 40 here. But when I grew up, the music had a lot of permanence to it. They would play songs like, Till the End of Time. And I'll be loving you always, you know. And now I was getting ready to go out, and the music was beat it, whip it, bite it, kick it, pinch it, you know. And I wasn't too sure. I wanted to find out what they were talking about, you know. And I remember the first date I went on, and it was a gal in the program, fortunately, and she had some understanding of these things. She had been married 8 or 9 times, I guess. She had been married so often she had rice scars, you know. And I showed up. The only way I knew how to date was the way I remember, you know, and it was flowers and candy. And she came to the door, and she looked at me, and she said, God love you. She said, you're Ricky Nelson in the John Travolta world, you know. And I was Ricky Nelson. You know, I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I didn't even know it before how, you know, how was I going to catch on that fast? And so I started to live life in a whole different realm, and the nice thing about it was that I was sober. I had had whatever that spiritual awakening is that they talk about, because I was awake. I knew what was going on around me, and life was getting very easy. And I had a little business in San Diego, and I always tried to make it work. I wanted to be a big shot, and it never worked. And so I went and started to do other things relating to Alcoholics Anonymous. And suddenly, things began to work. And I was having nothing to do with it. Honestly, having nothing to do with it. I remember a guy came into my office, and he had a big card at that time, and he laid it down. It was gold. And he was an efficiency expert. And he said, if you let me follow you around for a month, at the end of the month, I'll improve your productivity 25 to 30%. Guaranteed, but probably more like 45-50%, because you probably waste a lot of time. And I said, wow, is that impressive? He said, now let's start off with a few simple questions. Where do you get your clients? And I said, from God. And so he kind of looked a little funny and said, can you run with that? And I said, yeah, it's real simple. I said, I go over here and I do this little bozo activity I'm involved in. I said, and when I come back, something's happened here. And so the business began to take off, and I was there less and less. And I had a profit-sharing plan in this business, and at the end of the year, we used to get together and talk about the profit with the employees. And the deal was is we used to ask for recommendations. And by this time, they had become aware of the fact that it ran better when I wasn't there. And somebody suggested if I didn't come in at all, they could double it. And so, realizing my importance, I began to withdraw. And I didn't know why I did this at this particular time, but in 1983, an intuitive thought came to me. I didn't know then what it was all about, but I know today. And that intuitive thought said that I should go and get involved in the hospice program. So I began to work in the hospice program, working with people who are terminally ill. And in San Diego, they don't take you in the hospice program unless you're diagnosed to live a year or less. And so I went through the training program for the volunteers, and then the very first person they sent me out to was a guy who was about 72 years old, and he was dying of cancer, and he was very, very angry. And I said to him, his name was Stanley, I said, Stanley, why don't you tell me about what's going on with you? And he said, you'll have absolutely no understanding of it. And I said, why don't you give me a shot? So after some cajoling and coaxing, he finally looked me in the eye and he said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been sober 39 years. He said, and I should have gotten a cake 2 months ago, and with all this disease and the medication they have me on, I have no strength. He said, and I'm angry about it. And I looked at him in total amazement, although I shouldn't have been amazed. God likes to show off sometimes with bank shots. And so what I said to him is, Stanley, I said, I'm 14 years sober. And he looked at me with a little bit of amazement. And he was on methadone at that time. And I said to him, why don't you load up with that stuff, and we'll take you to a meeting. He loaded up, and I took him to a noontime meeting and gave him a 39-year cake. And Stanley was from the L.A. area. He had moved down there because he had some friends who were willing to help him in his last days, and he had helped start the Hole in the Ground meeting up in L.A. with Tex and Sybil and all that crowd. And the deal was is that he lived another whole year, and I got to give him a 40-year kick. And during that time, I had an opportunity to see this guy laying down do more than most people do standing up. I have guys call me on the phone, you know, whimpers and whiners. Ken, she's leaving, you know. Ken, I lost my job, you know. So I'd say, okay, grab your hanky and come on over. And we'll spend some time together, but I got a commitment to this guy. So they'd get to my house, and I'd load him in the car, and I'd take him down to see Stanley. And by now, Stanley had gone the whole route. He had gone the whole 9 yards. He had a colostomy. He had tubes running in and out of him. He was on oxygen. And I'd bring this little bozo in, and I'd say, Stanley, here's a guy having trouble in the program. And Stanley would whip off the oxygen. And he'd say, isn't it great? We got another day and we're sober. And he'd take off for 2 or 3 minutes till he ran out of oxygen. And then he'd flip the oxygen back on and he'd lay there and we'd visit him. And then we'd leave and we'd get outside and I'd look at this bozo and say, now tell me about your problems. And it's amazing how their problems had dissipated for that little short visit. And the deal is that that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me in this area. It works in all of my life. I can't take my life and break it down into compartments. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my life. That's who I am. That's what I do. And everything else fits in. It just fits in. I read how it works. And how it works for me, where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program. You know, every issue I have in my life, I've been able to address, in my case, through this program. I'm not diverse. You know, I don't have 18 things I'm involved in. You know, and that's where I am. I'm centered here. Every time it seems I hear someone who goes out and drinks again, it's because somehow they think they're different. I don't want to make myself different. I just want to be one of the bozos in AA. Just that simple. And as I said, I didn't know why I went through this hospice thing. But in 1985, I went home in October. I used to go home every October. We celebrated a lot of birthdays. My mom's birthday was in October. I had a sister, a brother. They were all in October. And I got home, and my sister was really looking bad. And everyone said she had a virus. And I knew the virus she had. In my family, we're divided into two groups. Either you're in AA or you need it. You know? And so I stayed there. We had the big family reunion and all that stuff. And I went home, and I wasn't home 2 days when my sister went into the hospital. And she was diagnosed as having cirrhosis. And she stayed in the hospital until Christmas Day, hemorrhaging, and she died Christmas Day of 85. And she was 54 years old. So I went back. Christmas was on a Wednesday that year. I went home, and we buried her. We wakened her 2 days and buried her Saturday. And then I flew back to San Diego because I was involved with the New Year's Eve deal that they have there. And New Year's morning, I received a call. My brother had passed away in a convulsion. So I flew back home again, and we buried him. Same thing. New Year's was on a Wednesday. And we buried him on a Saturday. And my nephew had seen his aunt die 1 week and his uncle die the next week. I picked up that afternoon for drunk driving. So we're slow learners here. We're real, real slow learners. And over the next 18 months, 7 people that were real close to me died. And I ended up going to the cemetery with much regularity. And I learned more about God and serenity and acceptance and love in that time than I've ever known before. I went to the cemetery and all the headstones are exactly alike. It has your name, when you were born, a dash, and when you die. And I don't care how long you live, the dash isn't more than 3 or 4 inches. And that's life. You know, that's life. I sometimes try to get people's attention by saying someday you and your closest friends will go to the cemetery and they'll come home without you. You know, so you learn to live in the now. It's real, real important to live in this now and not waste a moment of it. And I began to realize a whole new awareness at that point, a real, real awareness of how temporary this is. And my mom, who never expected to see her kids die young, passed away herself. And she had been fairly healthy up to that point. And I had a sister who died at 39 behind this. So the deal is I understand the disease. I understand it takes lives. But I know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we give life. You know, most people get caught up with the negative side of this thing. I like to look at the positive side, that this is what it's all about. It's getting out here and going to these little bozo meetings, participating in your recovery, being part of somebody else's recovery. This is not about ability. This is about availability. You know, being there when someone needs you, you know. Save us your intellectualism. Make the coffee, you know. Pick somebody up and bring them to a meeting. Do those kinds of things. That's what it's about. And the deal was, is I remember going back, by the time my brother had passed away a week later, my sponsor, this sensitive guy, he knew I was in a world of hurt. I was just breaking open with the pain I felt. And I wasn't a guy who showed pain real easy, but I was just coming apart with it. And the deal was, is when I got back there and I was at the funeral home, these guys started coming to see me. And this guy came up and said, "My name is Larry." And I said, "Oh, did you know my brother?" And he said, "No." He said, "Packy sent me." Packy was my sponsor. And he said, "To tell you, I got 30 days. You know? And then he'd leave and some other little bozo would show up an hour later or so. And he'd say, "Hi, my name is Joe." And I'd say, "Do you know my brother?" He'd say, "No, Packy sent me." He said, "To tell you, I got 26 days. And that's the way it was. It was this total awareness that no matter what was going on, I was okay. I could hurt and be okay at the same time. That's hard to understand unless you understand it. It's one of those paradoxes. I was okay. I was totally in that moment at that time. And it didn't make any difference that all these other things were going on. I knew I was going to be okay. Because I understood my own nature and what I was about. And I had a total understanding, at least at that time, of what God was for me. And that's the way it worked for me. And today, I do that stuff all the time. Last year, a fellow that Clint and I know was diagnosed as having cancer. And from the time he was diagnosed to the time he died was 1 month. And he never had any symptoms right up to the day he died. He never had any pain. He didn't even know he was dying. He had a brain tumor and he was totally disoriented. And the deal was, one day he had a moment of clarity and he said he hadn't been able to go to the bathroom at that time, and he was just all screwed up, and they sent a nurse out and they put a catheter in him and he was able to go to the bathroom. And in a moment of clarity he said, "Ken, can you bring me a milkshake?" So the next day I gave him a milkshake. And while I was giving it to him, he began laughing. And so I laughed, because I had no idea why he was laughing. And finally I said to him, "What are you laughing at, John?" And he said, "Life is so good." He said, "Today," he said, "I can drink this milkshake and pee." You know? And you get a chance when I'm not a doctor. I know nothing about nothing. Don't want to pretend that I do. But in my lifetime, because of some situations I grew up with as a kid, and because of a lifestyle that I lived, and later on because of being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and family, I've been there right at the moment of death when people leave. And I don't know, you know, I'm not a doctor who can sign a death certificate and say, "This is death." But when that life force leaves, you don't need anyone to explain it to you. You know it. You just know that what was there is not there now. And so you don't have any time to waste. You just go and you live life. And if people say, "Hey, do you realize you're doing this and you're wasting time?" You have two words for them, and they're not "Merry Christmas." You know? Because this is your life. It's not someone else's.
And you have to experience your experience. Truth does not come on the installment plan. One moment you're in darkness, and the next moment you're in truth. It comes all at once. And you have to experience your truth. The big book talks about this. Even down to the most basic issue of whether or not you're an alcoholic, it says, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, step next door and try to drink like a normal person. Try it more than once. Go and get your experience. Don't let anybody give it to you or try to give it to you. Go and get it, because once you experience it, then it's your truth. No one can take it away from you. And you don't have to explain who you are to anyone. I hear people spend so much of their life trying to explain life and trying to become something. You don't have to become anything. You already are. You're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's plenty. You know? Everything you ever can be, you are right now. That's hard to get through to some people. You don't have to become the richest, the prettiest, the skinniest, or whatever. I watch people come in from the outside and they read the book and they understand the program intellectually, but down deep they know nada. And they try to get well from the outside in, you know, to run or not to run, to fast or not to fast, you know, to get rich or not to get rich, to smoke or not to smoke. You go through this whole list of things, and if you've been around a while, it's like watching people changing deck chairs on the Titanic, you know. They run over here, and then they run over there, and then they run over here. And what you try to tell them in between the runs is the vessel is going down, you know? It doesn't make any difference how good you look. It's going down, you know? And then after they do all that, they go through all these little speed bumps in life, they get to a point where they come and they say, I don't know what's wrong. I've done all this nonsense, and I still have this hole in me. And you have that hole in you because you haven't filled it with a center. And the center you filled it with is God as you understand Him. That's what fills the center. You don't get well from the outside in. You get well from the inside out. Relationships. Oh, my God. You look for Miss Right or Miss Right Now, you know. I think she wants to go to bed with me. She smiled and gave me coffee, you know. And don't you women laugh. It's the same way for you guys. You know, after you're here a while, you realize we all swim in the same water, you know. The water is not different. And love is the most powerful force in the world. There is nothing stronger than love. In my edition of the big book, in one of the stories, He Who Loses His Life, it says, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is predicated on love. It's the core of it. And love and God are synonymous. And the deal is there's only two sins against love. The first is to interfere in somebody else's growth, and the second is to interfere in your own growth. You don't do either one of those. And people come here and we love you. We love you right from the get-go. We don't care that you lie. You know? Nobody ever comes in here and has a $10 deal. Oh, I was in this $1 million deal. I was in this $5 million deal. I was in this $50 million deal. You got a quarter? You know? You lend me a buck for gas? So we kind of suspect that maybe it wasn't that large. But we let you come and we let you lie because we love you. And once you find out that we love you, even though you're lying to us, and now you become aware of the fact that we know you're lying to us, then you get to a point where you don't have to lie, because you know it's not important. And then you get to the point where you let go of all your old ideas. This is not about learning a bunch of new stuff. This is about unlearning all the old stuff. Just getting rid of it, cutting it loose. And you watch people hold on to it. You know, the wheels fall off and we sew them back on, you know. It's like, I'm going to make it work. I got a program now. No, you're coming apart now. And my mom used to have a great story which sums up my whole spiritual experience for me. And she used to tell it with an Irish brogue. My mom told great stories. She raised 7 kids. It was no easy day, you know. It was no day at the beach. And she did the best she could. And she had a 4th grade education. And she didn't go out and be a career woman. She went out and worked. You know? Like the newcomers, I don't know what kind of career to get into. Get a job, you know? And my mom used to tell this story about Johnny. And Johnny went to a parochial school. And next to all parochial schools is a church. And Johnny's spiritual program was every day he'd run into this church and he'd kneel down. And he'd say, "Hello, God, this is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And then he'd boogie out and go to class. And in the afternoon, he'd go into the church, kneel down, say, "Hello, God, this is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And he'd boogie out. And he would do this winter, summer, spring, vacation. It didn't make any difference because this was his commitment. And about 12 or 13, he contracted polio before they had any cure for it. And he was in a room and he was dying. And the room was filled with his friends and his neighbors and his parents and his school chums. And my mom would say, a voice was heard to say, "Hello, Johnny. This is God. I just want to tell you, I'm here." You know? And that's what this is about. It's being there. See, when I was drinking, I couldn't be there. A lot of times I would have liked to have been there, couldn't be there. The disease got in the way. And the end result of that was I missed a lot. Missed an awful lot. But today, whenever anyone anywhere reaches out, we go. And it doesn't make any difference who goes. It's always the right one. And it doesn't make any difference what you say. It's always the right thing. There's nothing to figure out here. That's when you know you're home free, when you wake up and you say, there's absolutely nothing to figure out. This just is. And you get a chance to go and do the best things in the world that you ever imagined. A couple of weeks ago, I had a chance to stand in front of Mount Rushmore. The other day, Jeff, who was a very great host, took me out to this hole in the ground. You know, here's a kid from Brooklyn. I grew up in a neighborhood where mother was half a word. You know? There was no such thing as private property. We moved everything around. We went and we took. And that's how we learned. And the end result of that is today I'm in a world where everything is beautiful. And I don't listen to the news. The news is very disruptive. I come to AA meetings, you know? If you want to sit home and watch Slipovision, you know, that's your choice. You know an awful lot about everything until eventually you know all there is to know about nothing. And I get a chance to come here. And 2 things that I never would have thought I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is what you've given me. The first is a reason for living. The first is a reason for living. I now have a primary purpose. My primary purpose is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be there when these bozos call. And the second thing you've given me is a love affair that has never ended. I always wanted a love affair that went on. And you've given me that with a power of my own understanding. A love affair that can just grow and grow and grow. There's no end to it. And the end result of that is today I am happy, joyous, and free. Nobody owes me anything. If I were to check out on the way home, and I'm not volunteering, I'm okay. And the nice thing about the people who died in my life was as a result of being sober, we had no unfinished business. When I'm in front of someone today and I love them, I don't miss the opportunity to tell them I love them because I may never see them again. I've seen people at meetings leave very angry, and for some reason I never see them again. They don't necessarily make it back. So we hug each other and we kiss and we hold on because we come to understand that that's all there is. The rest of this nonsense is just sucking up oxygen. You go and you help some other human being. When you feel you have nothing to give, that's when you go. Because that's when you have everything to give. You have, I guess each one of us only have one gift that we can give the world, and that's the gift of self. So go and become you. We're all counting on you. Because if you don't give us that gift of you, we go wanting. We go without it. And don't try to be like somebody else. We already have one of those. Go and become the best you you can be. There is no doubt in my mind as I stand here before you that through each and every one of us, God is trying to become something he's never been before. He's trying to become something he's never been before. And that means that we're individualized. Very individualized. God's not Henry Ford. He doesn't make a 10,000 the same way. He makes one and then breaks the mold. And that one is you. So be you. We need you. Alcoholics Anonymous needs you. Everybody around you in this room, in this area needs you. And don't give up on yourself. And if you feel bad, like maybe you're not doing the right thing, just do the right thing. You know, there's a story about a pearl. And the pearl is one of the most fascinating stones there is in the world. It's in this oyster that some alien thing gets into this oyster. And it's a strange object. And what happens is the oyster, to protect itself, uses this fluid in it that's there all the time. It's dormant. But it uses this fluid to go and attack that alien subject. And what it does in the process of that pain is it creates a pearl. And that's what basically happens here. We create pearls. People bring us their pain. We show them the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of love. We even get them coffee in the beginning. And we make them feel welcome. This is your home. Keep coming back. And the end result of that is they become the pearl they're meant to be. You know, Apollinaire is a great Irish poet. He writes great stuff. At one time, I was in an institution of higher learning, supposedly. It was just an institution. And I used to read that stuff. And he has a great poem. It's called Come Down to the Edge. And in it, he says, come down to the edge. And the people say, no, we're afraid. And he says, come down to the edge. And they say, no, it's too high, we might fall. And he says, come down to the edge. And they come. And he pushes them off. And they fly. And they never know that fear again. Take good care of one another and have a great flight.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.